Hi there. Welcome to the AgriCurious podcast, and I'm excited to be here. I know it's been a while. Big shout outs to Dr. Alexa Lam for holding it down to talk to our guests from AgNext and the CLIA Center. Of course, it was a very interesting conversation, and if you missed any of that, just get to our previous episodes and get to learn all the research they're doing on livestock. Well, I'm happy to be here today. My name is Dennis Balfour Iwoa, the autistic scientist, and today we're following the conversation up with a very special guest. We will be talking about the role of meat in society. Now, I'll be talking to none other than Dr. Keith Belk, director of the Center for Meat Safety and Quality at the Colorado State University. So today we will be talking what it means to eat meat. What does meat mean to different cultures and societies world over? How do people perceive meat? What are some of the misconceptions people have about meat? What about all these movements that have rallied up against meat? What about what you usually hear lately, that plant-based meat protein is better than animal protein? What do we need to know? What is the right information? What is the wrong information? How does information impact your work? What are the misconceptions they face? Of course, today we will be busting some myths over here on the podcast. I am glad that you are here today. And so stick with me as we talk to Dr. Belk all about meat. It is the role of meat in society. We will be back. Thank you, Dr. Belk, for joining me today.
Yes, my pleasure. Excited about doing this.
It's a pleasure to have you as well. So I'll be delving straight into the questions. So first of all, I just would want to know from you, what initially sparked your interest in the field of meat science?
Well, I didn't start out to be a meat scientist. Probably that's true for most of the people that came before me. But I did learn as I was an undergraduate student here at CSU, it felt at the time like animal scientists weren't considering as much as they should the consumer level of the industry. In other words, what drove consumers to buy meat products to begin with? And when I say that, I mean things like animal geneticists would talk about productivity traits, but nobody would ever talk about what was really important, which was what the consumer thought of the products that we produced. And that has changed a lot over my lifetime now. But I became interested in further exploring those aspects of the animal industry. And so the road to doing that was in meat science. And of course, that's the scope of things I've worked on at this point has been much broader than the things I've described here. But it's been a great industry to work with because of the closeness that it has to consumers and consumer demand for products.
Well, that is an interesting development, and also talking about including consumers in the science of it. Now, please tell us next, how would you describe your work at the Center for Meat Safety and Quality to someone outside the world of agriculture or food science?
It's pretty common to receive questions about what I do. I sometimes have to explain it to my family. But basically, I'm the director of a center that is multidisciplinary in nature, meaning that we have scientists that work on different aspects of problems that face the animal industry. And that includes things like improving eating satisfaction with the products that are generated from the animal industry, improving the food safety of products that are generated from the industry. We've done a lot of work to facilitate greater trade of meat and livestock products internationally because of technical barriers or to trade that have occurred. And so we've worked in that space a bit. We try to do things that are objective and they span the entire extent of the supply chain, which really includes everything from the production of genetics in the industry all the way to the things that I've previously described, which are the consumer aspects of the industry and whether they like the products or not and whether they meet their needs or not. And so we work across that entire space, and it's very broad space. And that's the reason it has to be multidisciplinary, because we have different experts working in different parts of that supply chain.
That is impressive, Dr. Belk, with all you're doing at the center. So talking about meat, we know the importance that meat plays in our diet. But then there are misconceptions, which could be cultural or social. I don't know how that affects your work. I mean, if it does, would you mind telling us? And if you think there needs to be some kind of reframing of meat, but what do you think is missing that makes people feel otherwise about meat?
Let's start out and talk about human evolution. I think no matter what your value system and belief system is, it's pretty clear in the scientific literature that humanoids have been using meat as a primary source of nutrition for over 1.8 million years. I mean, almost since the beginning, whatever that looks like. I think that humans, their physiology is designed to utilize both plant and animal sources of foods as a nutrient. And I think that, and most of the archaeologists that work in this space think that need for nutrition evolved over a significant amount of time because of improvements in the species because of nutrient density that's tied to muscle foods. And so there's not been a time really in the history of human beings where meat hasn't been a primary component of nutrient dense nutrition for humans. We are in what we consider ourselves to be modern times now. The state of knowledge is increasing at exponential rates. Our ability to investigate the unknown is evolving and increasing at exponential rates. And so I think that we've come to a point in time where society has become removed from agricultural production. I think in North America today, and I might get these numbers wrong a bit, but only about 2% of the U.S. population is actually involved in the production of food products for the rest of society. That's not very much. And so what a friend of mine and that has spoken for me before discussed previously, Ed Pager from the University of Calgary, he talked about there being historically an agrarian model of knowledge about animal production. In other words, what he meant was that most of the population in society had some firsthand knowledge of what was entailed in the production of food, all the way back to primary production of animals or crops. Today, that's no longer the case. We're several generations on average today removed from actual firsthand knowledge about what is entailed in the production of food. And so most of society, 98% of our society, doesn't really understand the complexities of the systems that have developed to generate their food supply. And while those systems are critical to addressing food security and, more importantly, nutrition security issues, the fact that most of society doesn't really understand them is problematic. And so what that means is we're at a point today where we have to shift the way that we communicate how food is produced, and this applies to all foods, not just meat and livestock. We have to do a better job of explaining the complexity of those systems to consumers and to society in general to help them better understand why certain things happen the way that they do. That's hard to do. It's not an easy objective, but in most instances, the technical things that are tied to food production that some consumers have become afraid of, are actually there for a very important reason. And we just haven't done a good job of telling the story about why certain aspects of production occur the way that they do. And so as we have this modern food production system that is so many generations really removed from what most of society understands food production to be, it's created really a black hole in the knowledge base of consumers that we need to start remedying by helping them understand the science of food production. Don't know if that makes any sense or not, but it's a complex issue, but it's rooted in really ignorance about how food is produced.
Now, Dr. Belk, apart from this disconnect you speak about, do you think another thing that plays a factor is the rise of activism or even something like processed foods and the likes? I mean, is it not an irony that with all the advancements made in the food sector or even in meat production or the meat industry, people still really cling to the misconceptions? Is it not worrying?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's been, as society has moved away from agricultural production and taken jobs in the business world, you know, and taken jobs in the service industry and taking jobs in, you know, almost anything else that they participate in today, their firsthand knowledge of that production is not great. And I think that the opportunities to help them better understand that would address much of what you say, because they're exposed today to, quite frankly, an awful lot of misinformation, a lot of activism, a lot of bad science. And all of us that work in this space of education need to do a better job of helping them understand the difference between good, bad science, the difference between science and activism, the science between agendas versus technical information. All of those things become important. And the access to social media and other platforms of communication, because you have such quick and rapid access to, I'll call it information. I'm not saying good or bad information, but just total quantities of information. It's shifted in what society knows versus what is accurate relative to food systems. And so that's important. I don't know if that actually answers your question or not, but
yeah, it does. So, I mean, there's still misinformation out there, especially like you mentioned, with the rise of online platforms, social media, and all of that goes on right now. Would you say that the right way or tool to educate the public will be through the same media or platform or means through which the misinformation is spread? Will that be a good approach, or should there be some other way to educate the public on the right things?
I think that's a really good question. It's a key question in what we've been trying to work on. I truly respect Dr. Lamb for having way more knowledge about this area than I do. It's been, I think, one of the science's worst capabilities. It has related to our inability to communicate what we do and what we learn to society at large. And so the answer to your question is, I'm not sure what the best mechanism is to address this, but I will tell you this. There's been some recent literature generated. There was a study published in Science Magazine last year, which is actually a scientific journal, where the investigators evaluated what kinds of misinformation are being generated in social media. And they were looking not just at agriculture, it didn't have anything to do with agriculture, it was looking at all, you know, issues that are faced by society today. But what they determined is that there's what they called super shares of misinformation. So when I see their description of these characteristics, what I think about is activists that are multiplying and exponentially increasing the amounts, the total quantities of misinformation that are being generated on social media platforms that actually lead consumers that are not knowledgeable themselves about the scientific method down a bad path of knowledge. And they can have an outsized, what the authors of the article stated is they can have an outsized harm on society because of this rapid and massive release of misinformation and false information into the public. And my opinion is there's two things we have to address. The first of those is we have to address scientists that have become agenda-driven scientists. That's not right. And then we have to address this release of misinformation and falsified information into the public. There's two places there then where we need to, as a scientific profession, we need to hold those that are responsible for those two bad things from happening. We need to hold them accountable for that. It's not acceptable behavior by any standards. And we need to figure out mechanisms for holding them accountable for what they're doing and causing this kind of outsized harm as was described in this article. And I think that's important. I'm just not sure how to do it. So
I think you are spot on, Dr. Belk. People need to be held accountable. And I personally think it's time scientists come down to the level of consumers through whatever right means available to be able to connect with the consumers or even the public, to have their messages resonate with them. Again, like we have already said, meat forms an integral part of our diet. However, certain movements encourage some alternatives instead, like plant-based meat or meat from plant sources. Would you say plant-based meat products or plant-based meat are better alternatives? Or you say such alternatives provide same nutrition as meat?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, we're on the fringes here of my expertise, but I will tell you, there's a couple things that are true. Firstly, those that are advocating against the consumption of meat-based protein are not, they're doing a disservice to society. And that is evident by what has occurred over the past 35, 40 years since the idea of dietary guidelines evolved. If you look at, for example, just in the United States, dietary guidelines began being produced in essentially the early 1950s, 60s, 70s era. And since they began to be used to tell people what to eat, maybe against their own cultural backgrounds or value systems or whatever, just in North America, obesity has increased almost linearly. Now, I realize there's a number of factors that contribute to that, but the first and foremost factor is the diet. And so the fact that there are advocates, activists is what I would say, that are trying to convince people that you should consume less of muscle protein as a composite of as a proportion of your composite diet. They're doing a disservice. And what they're causing people to do is consume more carbohydrates, more highly processed foods, as you described earlier. And each of those things is contributing to chronic illnesses in populations that have, you know, access to all of those types of foods. So they're doing a disservice to society at large. The second thing I would say about this is that even the people that are truly nutrition scientists, which I'm not, but people that are truly nutrition scientists, and there are some really good ones around the world, even that their work has what I would call holes in it relative to somebody saying that you should eat something versus something else. And the reason that I'm telling you this is because there's no standardization in terminology that's used across differing studies. For example, what constitutes a processed meat in one study might be a fresh meat or considered to be a fresh meat in another study. There's huge gaps in standardized nomenclature that's used to characterize the diets in those types of studies. Now, I don't do nutrition research, but when you have that variety of nomenclature used across hundreds of studies, then you know that it's going to lead to things being taken out of context and misinformation because of the lack of standardization there. And so we talk about that a lot. What I believe today has become important is what a good friend of mine who is an expert in this space says, Frederick Leroy, who's in Brussels, Belgium. He talks about the need for us to begin looking at minimizing highly processed food intake, which does not include meats, and focusing more of our diets on within our culture and geography and locality and other factors in our lives, focusing on nutrient density. Because as you improve nutrient density and you particularly address micronutrient needs in diets, then what ends up happening is it becomes pretty clear that meat has to be some component of people's diet for health and well-being. And that's not based on advocacy. That's based on what the evidence says is more appropriate diet across a wide spectrum of cultures and beliefs and other value systems. And so we sort of like this idea of a nutrition table where you measure on one axis nutrient density and you measure on the other axis the degree of processing that occurs to manufacture that food, which generally causes reduced nutrient value, and look at those within the spectrum of all kinds of geographies around the world and cultures around the world. And I kind of like that. I mean, it gets away from the idea that people should be telling you what to eat. I don't like that idea.
All right. So from what you say, there are some kind of standards that is missing. Standardization with which people or researchers can conform to some certain parameters that we really do not have. Is that truly missing in the space? Whose role is it in fixing it?
It's missing. There's organizations that have tried to address this. For example, the American Meat Science Association a few years ago developed what they called the lexicon for meat. A lexicon is essentially descriptors that could be used for those that are interested in trying to standardize this nomenclature in research. But I haven't seen those that conduct nutrition research utilize that lexicon publication in a large way. And that's a mistake, because in instances, what you have is scientific advocacy, and scientific advocacy is problematic. The science should develop new information. Society should be able to develop their values and use that information in determining how they're going to live their lives. I don't think that it's the scientist's role to indoctrinate, but I do believe it's the scientist's role to objectively identify information about the unknown that previously did not exist. And so this is going way into the weeds on your question, but it's important as we move into the future that there be some form of standardized nomenclature that can be understood by society at large to help them make their own decisions about what's good and bad in their diets. So.
All right, so you are logged on to the AgriCurious podcast. It's been an interesting conversation so far with Dr. Keith Belk, the director of the Center for Meat Safety and Quality at Colorado State University. And we are talking about meat, of course. It forms a very important part of our diets. Whichever form you take it, you probably like it. And we're talking all about it. What are the perceptions, misconceptions, the way to go around it? What is the right education about meat? Over here on the AgriCurious podcast, brought to you by the Lamb Lab and with the Autistic Scientists. We will be back. Thank you once again, Dr. Belk, for joining us here. Now, let me ask this, Dr. Belk. This is quite social, and the people have concerns. Is there anything like good meat or bad meat?
Well, I kind of believe in the dietary needs idea. I think that there's a need for all types of foods in the diet, but I think that those need to be in moderation. That's the word that we used to use. You can consume too much meat at the expense of other needs in the diet, and vice versa. You can easily consume way too many carbohydrates in the diet at the expense of useful protein and micronutrients that are needed. And so I want to go back to what we said 30 years ago. I mean, diets should be, they should reflect your cultural and your family beliefs, your location beliefs. But they should be, and I don't like to use this word, but they should be balanced to encompass all foods in moderation to address a healthy lifestyle.
Right. And you did answer my next question, which was just basically going to find out if we can quantify or say somebody's consuming more meat or not. But you have really touched on that. But then also the next thing I want to know from you is about the U.S. consumer. Now, from an ethical standpoint, what are the most pressing concerns U.S. consumers specifically have about meat production? And is there a way the industry is responding to this?
According to the data that's collected by the industries, the livestock and meat industries themselves, the number one concern in consumers after price is quality. And then that's closely followed by animal well-being and animal handling practices during the raising and harvesting of livestock. And I would say that, you know, here at Colorado State University, I've worked with Temple Grandin for close to 35 years now and consider her a good friend. And so we've taken the idea of helping producers address consumer concerns about animal well-being, I would say, to the nth degree. We think it's an absolute requirement of doing business in this industry, and we've taken that seriously. So while there are extremes out there around a normal distribution that perhaps don't conform to expectations regarding animal well-being and animal welfare concerns, I think that those are very, very minute in terms of the overall production of livestock. And I think most of the animal well-being concerns are now part of all of the voluntary quality assurance programs that all of the livestock species employ in their own production practices. So it's something that the industries take seriously, is my point. And so they've heard what the consumers have said about that. And while we can always get better at everything, they've taken those things seriously. That's the number one thing. There's other concerns that are, you know, show up, things like food safety, which are absolutely a requirement of doing business. Things like, I'm going to use the word sustainability, although there's not a real good definition for that. Sustainability issues tied to livestock production are really not that important to consumers, at least currently. They may grow in their importance in the future, but they're not today. Nonetheless, that doesn't mean that the industry shouldn't be trying to do the right thing. And so there's a number of folks that are working in that space to help the industry get better and addressing things that could be a concern to consumers in the future. So those things are not being ignored. I have to say that the industries themselves, no, not scientists, but the industries themselves, they collect a massive amount of data on what drives consumers to and away from their products. And so they provide pretty good feedback to producers on, you know, here's the things we need to be doing if we're going to satisfy consumer demand. And they take it very seriously.
Thank you very much. So I also want to find out from you, well, the world is evolving, research is also advancing. And so there are several technologies to do things. So when it comes to meat production, there are different technologies that have come to stay, like genetic engineering, and we can talk about meat culture as well. Now, from where you stand, what is the future of meat like with these technologies? When we talk about genetic engineering, I mean, do you see it playing a significant role in our food systems? What about something like meat culture as well?
We'll start with genetic modification. With gene editing capabilities that have evolved and gotten better and better, like CRISPR techniques, for example,
yeah.
I think that we're right on the verge of seeing those techniques being used to produce more food more efficiently
with better consideration of the animals in mind as we do so. In a meeting that we hosted last October, we invited a speaker in to discuss the use of those technologies. Her name's Allison Van Eneman. She's a professor at UC Davis. And the capabilities that we have for using both reproductive and genetic traits in livestock and poultry production are really quite incredible. What is slowing the adoption of some of those capabilities is actually regulatory. It's taking society a long time to figure out how to wade through the needs of regulatory approval systems to make those technologies available. You probably noticed just in the last week or two of this doing this discussion, there's been new technologies approved in the swine industry that will help address the PRRS virus. And those are based on genetic modification. So do I think those things are coming? Absolutely. I think there's a lot we don't know about the genomes of livestock. We probably know much more about the genome of human beings than we know about livestock. But I think into the future, we can see those technologies being used much more. The culture part of it is important. And but let me add to that the context of that a little bit. Of course, if you travel around the world much, there's cultures that depend on meat and cultures that don't depend on meat. They depend on other protein sources. But most of the world depends on some form of, poultry or fish, aquatic or livestock-based protein system. And so that is part of their culture, and it has been something that has become, I will use the word, center of the plate for family gatherings and for, all the things that make up a healthy lifestyle. But there's some other aspects of this conversation that are also important based on some of the speakers that we had at our meeting last October. The first of those is how much of the land base around the world can be utilized to feed 10 billion people if we don't have ruminants. I think everybody is aware of the fact that, human beings cannot digest cellulose, but ruminants can. And so by using ruminants to harvest some of the grasslands that can't be used for any other purpose, we're actually improving the lifestyles of mankind while simultaneously being more efficient in how we use the planet. And so there's that aspect of the philosophy of using animals for food that becomes very important. And that feeds into the cultural issues that are tied to meat as food. The second aspect is, what is the physiological needs of human beings relative to a strong diet? And if you look at what it takes to grow plant-based diet that would fully satisfy human dietary nutrition needs, it's almost impossible that the planet would have enough land space to be able to do that without the nutrient-dense opportunities that are presented using animal agriculture. And I'm not excluding marine agriculture or aquaculture or poultry production. I mean, all of them contribute to this ability to feed a growing population. And so there are some philosophical things that are linked to the cultural background of human beings that become important in considering the context of, where meat fits in a global diet.
So I would want to know from you, from where you stand, what is one thing that you wish every consumer knew about the journey from farm to plate?
Well, it's a much more complicated system than what most consumers are aware of. And you can pick a species, and each of those species is extremely it's a complicated, sophisticated system. And the production practices that have evolved over time because of science that have then been adopted into that production system, which is what the land grant system was supposed to accomplish when Abraham Lincoln signed the first bill to create the land grant schools. The whole purpose of that was to help
accelerate the uptake of new technology into production systems. And it's been hugely successful, maybe perhaps in North America more than other places that don't have extension systems. But the result of that is it's created much more sophisticated and complicated food production systems than what we had 100 years ago. And they're constantly becoming more complicated because of the continual development of new techniques and technologies. And so many of those techniques and technologies are difficult for consumers to get their arms around because they're things that are used to make them afraid. And I'm not saying that consumers shouldn't be cautious about making food choices. They should definitely be cautious. But I think it's also our duty to help them better understand what some of these technologies and practices are. And I mentioned earlier, since they become further and further or more less engaged with agricultural production than previous generations were, that problem becomes more insurmountable as time goes on. And so it's our job as an industry or as scientists to help them better understand why those practices are used, what the benefits are, what the trade-offs are, how they work, what the science says about using them as a technology. Those things all integrated into that. And part of that goes to what we talked about earlier, just, you know, our need to do a better job of relating to and communicating with society as a whole. So,
right. So I know we have many people that will be listening to this particular podcast, and there will be young ones as well. Now, I would want you to give one advice to people out there, especially the young ones who would want to be like you. What advice would you give to them as they are interested in food systems or even in meat science?
Well, I kind of feel like a grandfather now telling young students what I think. And I realize that times have changed, that our population has changed, that our demographics have changed, that our access to information has changed. There's a lot of things that have changed in my lifetime. When I started out, we were still punching computer cards to make runs on mainframe computers. So even that technology has changed a lot. So I don't have all the answers, but I will say this. One thing that has been time-tested and that I believe is true is that young people that have a passion for this space, for trying to produce food to address the food security needs of a world that is growing in population size, if they have a passion for that, there's two things that will work for them. Number one is working hard.
Right.
You can't solve those problems resting on your laurels. You have to work hard. And everybody that I know that's been successful as a scientist or out in the industry, in the profession, has worked hard. And then the second thing is it's okay to be passionate about something without necessarily always having to consider the financial considerations. Everybody needs to make a living. But when you get to be my age, you look back on your life and you say, you know, the impact that we've tried to have in helping society become better, to help people's lifestyles become better, their living conditions to become better, that's pretty rewarding. And quite frequently, that's more rewarding than any of the financial things that were provided on that journey. And so while I understand that everybody needs to make a living, it's good to be able to look back and be proud of what you accomplished relative to impact. And so I think as young students begin to enter the process for, let's just say, becoming scientists in whatever discipline they have an interest in, passion and work ethic are hugely important. And I don't think those things will go away. And so those are the people that I believe are going to be leaders of the next century.
Okay. That is beautiful. Thank you so much for that. All right. So now, any final thoughts on how society should rethink or reclaim its relationship with meat?
Well, you know, it's funny that you asked me that. I think it's actually happening right now, surprisingly. Maybe not worldwide, but for certain in North America, if you look at what's happened to the supply, I'm going to use beef as an example here. This applies to all species, but I'm going to use beef as an example. Look at what's happened to the supply of beef that's available for consumers. It's declined to the lowest levels since the 1960s. And so what that has caused, when you know, understand, you know, macroeconomics and supply and demand, it's caused huge prices at retail for beef products. And yet, what is most surprising to a lot of us is that consumers, because of what beef offers as a food to them, whether it's nutritionally or from a eating satisfaction perspective, they're continuing to buy it, even at these much higher prices. Demand has not declined, even given reduction in supplies available. And so what that tells me is that most of our population, I'm not saying all of it, but most of it still has a preference for the nutrient density and the eating satisfaction and the cultural things that are tied to consuming meat. And I think that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And when you combine that with the fact that, and I'm speaking mostly to ruminants here, but when they're harvesting grasslands that can't be utilized for any other means, it makes that a relatively efficient, nutrient-dense option for diets. And so perhaps we're seeing a revolution just as we're speaking here.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr. Belk. It's been interesting and fun and also very insightful talking to you on this episode. I really appreciate you taking time off to join us today to have this conversation about meat. It is a very important conversation, and I have learned a lot from this. Thank you so much. But then before you go, I would want to know from you, where can listeners learn more about your work or follow your developments from your center, talking about the Center for Meat Safety and Quality?
Yeah, we try to publish everything in peer review. We believe in the scientific method, and more importantly, the objective scientific method. And so we published everything that we do here in peer-reviewed scientific literature. And sometimes those are more impactful and less impactful journals, but they're all published. And so that's always an option. We also, though, try to engage with society through several mechanisms and means. And so most of our faculty and staff are out there working to help people know what we're doing and what we're working on a constant basis. And from our vantage point, we are a land grant institution, and we believe in the land grant purpose that Abraham Lincoln had when that system was created. And so we try to live by the fact that we're a service organization. We're trying to do things that benefit all of society. And when we can stand back and say that we've had an impact in that regard, I think that it's important. But we are always available to answer questions. And so if others that have questions about the things that we work on, they can contact us via any means at any time. And we're always willing to help answer those questions. So,
okay, thank you. Are you on social media?
We are. I'm not personally, other than just watching peripherally, but we have people that better understand social media than I do, and right. we're on it constantly.
Okay. Yes. So I'm asking because we spoke about it, and it's one of those media that we can use to propagate all the truths and all the right information about what we just discussed. So, Dr. Belk, thank you so much for joining us on this one. We really appreciate you taking time off to talk to me about meat and its role in our society, the misconceptions and all the issues surrounding it. This has been a very good one. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity and really good questions.
Thank you. Dr. Belk is the director of the Center for Meat Safety and Quality, Colorado State University. And you had all the educative things we have discussed over here. Of course, this is your favorite podcast where you get to learn all about food systems and all the things that go on in producing the food that you eat that ends up on your plate. We'll be talking about everything. There's so many topics that are yet to come. But this is also very interesting with Dr. Belk. We appreciate him for taking time to give us this education. I appreciate you for tuning in too. And it's the AgriCareers Podcast. My name is Dennis Bafo-Ewa, a.k.a. the Autistic Scientist. Let's catch up again on the next episode. Be safe.